Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. When you're dealing with legal issues and legalese, it's important to know exactly what's going on. The world of elder law and estate planning can be confusing to navigate. That's why you'd hire a lawyer, or at the least, consult with one. We just happen to have a lawyer in the studio with us, well-versed in elder law and estate planning, who is here to answer your questions. Frank Lang is the president of Lang Law Firm and has an extensive litigation background. He's a member of the American Bar Association and practices elder law, including estate planning, Medicaid planning, guardianship, and planning for people with disabilities. If you have a question about a legal matter that pertains to elder law or estate planning, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. You can also comment at the bottom of today's show page at our website, wamc.org/voxpop. You could comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on Facebook. It's facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But we love your calls. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Frank Lang, nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
What a quagmire of legal issues. At what age should one begin to worry about this?
Pretty much as soon as you've got something that you might be leaving to somebody else, or if you have heirs that you're concerned about protecting. So certainly when people are getting married and having children, they ought to be starting to do their basic estate planning, because if something happens to you and your spouse, you get to pick who's going to be the guardian of your minor children, or you get to pick at what age you would like them to inherit from you, or under what conditions you would like them to be able to access the money that they inherit from you.
What's the biggest mistake people make when they start this process?
Well, there are a couple of big mistakes. One mistake that I see an awful lot, because I focus on elder law, are the people who think they're going to live forever. And the second biggest mistake is the people who don't think they're going to live forever, but who think they're never going to get sick before they die. So we want to try to prepare ourselves for what's going to inevitably happen when we do leave this veil, but also what's going to happen if we become incapacitated along the way. Who do we want to have make decisions for us? What kind of circumstances do we want for healthcare decisions? If, for instance, I'm brain dead, or if I'm terminally ill with no hope of recovery, do I want somebody to pull the plug, or do I want to stick around and wait for that miracle that might be coming?
So this is about much more on a philosophical scale than just protecting assets.
Exactly, exactly. And there are, people have interesting notions about what's going to happen if they don't take the bull by the horns and put their planning into place. If you die without a will in New York State, your property is going to go where the legislature thought you wanted it to go.
Yeah.
I have yet to meet anybody who actually thought that's where it was going.
Okay. Well, that's good advice already. Frank Lang is our guest. We talk estate and elder law today, and let's go right to the phones. Robert in Middletown. Robert, you're up.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome. I had
a situation where my aunt recently passed away. No survivors to speak of. No next of kin anyway. Anyway, she was on Medicaid. Now, this pertains, she was in the state of Connecticut, so I don't know if your guest's area of expertise extends to Connecticut Medicaid.
I have a little familiarity with it.
But that's a great question that we'll tackle later. It varies from state to state. But go ahead, Robert.
Oh, okay, thank you. Now, my aunt recently passed away, and again, she was she had no income, and up until about a year and a half ago, she had real no assets until my uncle passed away, and he left no will, and she was a surviving next of kin, along with my mother, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened was my uncle's, for various reasons, my uncle's estate is still in probate, although it's about to, come out of it. And she passed away while his estate was in probate. So I'm wondering, and we wanted to pay her funeral expenses and things like that. And I spoke to several Connecticut departments, DSS, Administrative Services. I was told varying things. A, that the state would go after half of my aunt's estate to cover, the cost of her Medicaid. She was under their care for several years. I was then told by the Department of Administrative Services that they would go after all of it, and they would only pay up to $1,800 for the funeral expenses. So needless to say, I'm a little confused.
Okay. Well, I can tell you what the answer would be in New York State. I'm not sure what the answer is going to be in Connecticut, but I suspect it's going to be similar. In New York State, when you or your spouse receives any kind of Medicaid benefits, the Department of Social Services is charged under the social services laws with trying to recover the cost of those benefits back from either your estate or your spouse's estate. So in this instance, if she was receiving Medicaid benefits, my guess is they will be looking to her estate first and then to her husband's estate to be made whole for whatever those benefits were. And then if there's anything left over, that would be available to the heirs.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that Medicaid paid a lot more. It's a very small estate, and she was divorced, so, and her husband passed away years ago.
What I would suggest is that you want to talk to an attorney who's licensed to practice in the state of Connecticut who does work in this area. And one of the ways that you can find people like that is if you go to the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. It's abbreviated NAELA. And they have a nice little drop-down box on their page that says find an elder law attorney. You can click on that, and they'll give you a list of attorneys within a certain proximity of the city that you're looking for. And pretty much anybody who's in NALA is somebody who practices a lot in that area and ought to be able to help you, and most of them are willing to give you a free consultation.
Well, that'd be great. All right, thank you very much. I always talk to the lawyer who's handling my uncle's estate, because my mother is executor on that estate, and I couldn't get a clear answer from him, so I think I'll follow your suggestion, and I thank you very much for taking my call and giving me the advice.
Oh, you're welcome. Good luck with it.
Robert, thanks a lot for the call. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. I should point out that while Frank Lang is eminently qualified to give you specific answers to your questions, the radio is not the proper venue, so these are sort of general suggestions, right?
Correct.
Okay, let's go to Ed in Pittsfield. Ed, you're up.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. The reason I was calling is my 90-year-old mother passed away back in November, and we recently got a letter from MassHealth saying they were establishing a $30,000 lien on her estate. And I was wondering if there was any way we could reduce that or get it deferred.
Well, I guess the first question is, did somebody open up an estate for her? In other words, did somebody go to surrogate's court or probate court and file her will or file paperwork to have somebody appointed as her executor or administrator?
My sister is her personal representative, if that's what you mean.
Okay.
She could do a probate thing.
Okay. So then typically what would happen is, that, again, to the extent that the state expended money on her behalf during her lifetime, they will have a lien that they are going to present to her estate. In my experience, at least in New York State, the state is very reluctant to compromise or diminish the amount of its lien. So if under certain circumstances you can try to suggest to them that you wouldn't be able to liquidate an asset or collect assets unless it was going to be worth your while, and if they're not willing to compromise your lien, that you're not going to bother to do it. But in this instance, if we've already gone through the steps of opening up an estate, the pathway is already there for the state to come in and present that lien. So my guess is you're not going to be able to get them to compromise it.
Okay, because I was taking care of her for the past 2 years, and I'm disabled. I don't know if that makes any difference or not.
Well, it would have made a difference if some things had been done back when she was alive. Yeah, there were things that we could have done to transfer her assets to you as a disabled child that are available in our New York state law. And again, I'm not licensed to practice outside of New York, so I can't say with certainty that those avenues would have been there. But that's another reason why, as a general proposition, when you get to the stage where somebody's going into a nursing home, that's the time to pick up the phone and try to find an attorney who can give you some advice about ways to avoid that outcome.
All right.
Ed. Okay, she never went into a nursing home, but I won't take up any more of your time.
Okay.
I'll get an estate lawyer here.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, sir.
That's a good plan. And so if you transfer assets, if you reach that stage with, my gosh, I'm going into assisted living or even something more than that, and you transfer assets, then does capital gains tax come into play?
Well, there's a bigger issue there, and that is if you transfer assets for less than fair market value within 5 years of the date that you want to apply for Medicaid, that's going to result in a denial of your Medicaid benefits in most instances.
Interesting.
Now, there are some exempt transfers that you can make. So, for instance, in New York State, you can transfer assets back and forth between spouses. So if I had a stroke tomorrow and I had to go into a nursing home, I could, provided that I had somebody had a power of attorney and could effectuate that for me, could transfer all of my assets to my wife, apply for Medicaid for me, and I would be eligible for Medicaid.
All right, let's pick that up in a moment. Zach, we're going to take a break here. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. We talk estate planning and elder law with Frank Lang of the Lang Law Firm. Back in a flash.
Support for WAMT comes from the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting A View from the Shore, Winslow Homer's Impressions of the Coast, wood engravings and etchings made after Homer's paintings, now through August 24th, arkellmuseum.org. Foresight Land Services, for over 45 years, offering civil engineering, land surveying, planning, and environmental permitting to private and municipal clients in the Berkshires and Eastern New York. ForesightLand.com. University at Albany, offering a weekend MBA program for 22 months, including a study abroad session, 518-956-8330. And Springhouse Spa, Sharon Springs, New York, a modern-day spa in a historic setting, offering Father's Day gift certificates online, springhousespa.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Frank Lang is president of the Lang Law Firm and has an extensive litigation background, and he knows estate planning and elder law. And before the break, you had mentioned the possibility of spouses transferring assets back and forth. In the case where one spouse has a stroke and is incapacitated and no longer has power of attorney, does the state say, well, you can keep doing that if you want?
Well, in that instance, if we didn't have the ability to make the transfers on behalf of that disabled spouse, we could go to court and have somebody appointed as his or her guardian. And New York state law is very clear that a guardian acting on behalf of a ward could do anything that the ward could do. We have the doctrine of substituted judgment here. So if it was a rational and reasonable thing to do Medicaid planning, the courts would allow that Medicaid planning to be done by the guardian.
Okay. Let's go over to Deborah in Kingston. Deborah, you're up.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
So I have a couple of questions. One, do you think it's necessary to have someone assist in obtaining Medicaid? Is that because it seems to be a lot of people that are advertising for that service?
That's a good question. And it depends a little bit on what you're doing. If what you're doing is plain vanilla, if we've got a situation where there haven't been any transfers of assets during that 5-year look back period, and where you're clearly underneath the somewhat arbitrary cutoff for resources and income, then you can just go to the Department of Social Services because it's their job to help you fill out the forms. And if you're having difficulty getting something, as long as you tell the Department of Social Services that you're not able to do it, it triggers an obligation on their part to undertake what's called a collateral investigation to find that information for you. So if there's nothing exotic about what you're doing, yeah, you can go right to the Department of Social Services. On the other hand, if you're going to do something interesting like trying to make an exempt transfer between spouses or to a disabled child or to a caregiver child, something that's a little out of the ordinary, then you might want to have either a law firm or a paralegal firm help you do it. And there are a number of paralegal firms out there who generally speaking are a little less expensive than an attorney would be, but as far as I can see are perfectly capable and competent of doing it. And most of them have some attorneys that they work with as backup in case there is a legal issue that pops up.
Okay. So you said a caregiver child, because that would be, I am the child, like a personal services contract. Is that what you're talking about?
Yep. But they're also under New York State Medicaid laws, for instance, if you are a caregiver child and you have moved into mom or dad's house and lived there for at least 2 years prior to them going into the nursing home, there's an exception that says we can transfer the family house to you. And so that's a great way of saving the family house.
And did they come after what the other person asked earlier? Is a family home an asset that they come after?
It can be, yeah. I mean, when they're counting up your assets for Medicaid eligibility, they count the value of everything, the value of your house. If you have a life insurance policy, they count the cash value in the life insurance policy. So pretty much anything that's got the Medicaid applicant's name on it is going to count towards their cutoff for Medicaid. And if you're married and one of the two is going into the nursing home, the person going in can have $14,400. Then the community spouse, the one who's at home, can keep a house and a car. And there's a range. The low end of it is $74,000. The high end of it is about $109,000, and still be eligible for Medicaid.
But again, when you say that you can be eligible for Medicaid, but afterwards that can be they can seek reimbursement from those?
They can seek reimbursement from the probatable estate of either the Medicaid applicant or his or her spouse. So one of the things that we look at when we're doing planning is if my spouse is going to go on into the nursing home and get on Medicaid, I want to make sure that all of my assets are titled in a way so that they're not going to go through probate. So if I set them up jointly with my children or payable on death to my children, or I set up a trust for myself, when I eventually die, none of that is going to go through probate. And so the Department of Social Services won't have an opportunity to come in and assert that lien.
All right.
Okay, so I have one more question.
Okay.
Thank you so much. This is about my mother I'm talking about. She, and she'll admit this, but she gambles. And she seems to think that if she loses whatever money that she has, she's about to sell her home and then later needs Medicaid, that if she doesn't have any money, that that won't be considered as part of like a look back. And my inclination is that in other words, like if she transferred funds and they look at that, that they would look and say, well, what happened to that money? And they wouldn't sanction just having gambled it away. Am I correct?
Well, what it comes down to is this. If you give away money for less than fair market value, that's considered to be a transfer that disqualifies you. If you spend money, regardless of what you spend it for, they don't penalize you. So if she can show that if she can keep the receipts and show that she went to the casino and gambled this money away, the Department of Social Services may just say, okay, you spent it on something foolish, but nevertheless, you didn't give it away for purposes of becoming eligible for Medicaid. So that should not be treated as a transfer, but she needs to be, certainly if she's going to be gambling away a lot of it, she needs to keep very good records.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks
all right, thank you so much.
And maybe she'll win. Julie in Shady, you're up. Julie, are you
there? Oh, hi, guys.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. My partner and I have been living together for 13 years, and we co-own a home, and we do have wills, and we're each other's beneficiaries, but we are not legally married. Is it to our advantage to do so?
There are advantages and disadvantages to being married. In my experience, I think that there are probably more advantages to being married. But for instance, if you are not married and one of you gets ill, the other person does not have any legal obligation to support you, including paying for your medical bills. Whereas if you were married under New York State law does impose that obligation on spouses. So it would be worth sitting down with an attorney and going over what those pros and cons are, just so that you're aware of
we both have Medicare and supplemental insurances.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is that I wasn't sure of is if either one of us, if we were to get married, if either one of us would die, does the other get the person who's alive's Social Security benefit?
Yeah, generally, you do. If the other person's Social Security benefit is higher than yours, then you can, if you're married, you get the higher amount.
Oh, you just don't get the total benefit.
No, you can you get the
get
higher.
Both, yeah.
You won't double dip, but
that's
you can,
a Perry Mason episode waiting to happen.
Yeah,
you got both. Yeah. No,
oh, okay. And one more little question is: we have wills that just slightly have to be updated. Now, I'm sure we should go to an attorney to have this done, but if something would happen before we got to that point, if we changed it ourselves in writing and initialed it, does it count?
Generally speaking, the circuit court frowns on that, and they would most likely take the view that by altering the will, you have rendered it invalid. So I would absolutely positively suggest that you not do that.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Thank you. You've answered my questions.
Good luck.
Julie, thank you very much. Number to call here on Vox Pop is 1-800-348-2551. We're joined by Frank Lang of Lang Law Firm in Latham and Oneonta, New York. Al in Rhinebeck is next. Al. Hello, Al. Hello, Al. Are you there? All right.
Ooh.
Hello, Al. All right. Al, Jim, what's your name? Oh, for Pete's sake. All right. Daniel in Highland. Daniel, is that you?
Yes, how are you?
You're on.
Hi. I was looking for advice on dealing with elder people as far as renting farmland for long-term periods. I'm looking to get a long-term lease on some land. Most of the people I approach are concerned, you know, they basically say, oh, I can't do a lease that long, implying, you know, hey, I'm 85 and what do you... I've heard that you can put some sort of clauses in the lease that it will last beyond any transfer, but that doesn't really sound right to me. Would I have to have the, either, you know, a child who is going to inherit the land sign on to the lease as well, or...
Nope. Basically, if the person that you're leasing from owns the property outright and there's nobody else who's got a property interest, they could sign a 100-year lease. And what you would want to make sure is that you record that lease at the county clerk's office so that now that piece of property is burdened with your lease. And as long as you live up to the lease terms and make your payments on time and don't do anything else to give the subsequent owner an opportunity to break the lease, your lease is still going to march on.
Okay, that's good to know then.
Yeah, so you know, they may be uncomfortable doing it, but
it's always an incredibly personal conversation.
Yeah,
with, you know what I mean.
But there's no legal impediment to it.
All right, well, great. That clears things up. Thank you.
Okay,
Daniel. It's Vox Pop on WAMC Elder Law Estate Planning Today. Bill in Albany. Bill, you're on.
Good day, gentlemen. I'm calling because I get together with my retired buddies once a month, and I was the butt of everyone's joke during lunch because my wife and I have long-term health care, and we pay approximately $7,000 annually for this long-term health care. Most of my retired buddies don't have long-term health care, and they think it's a joke.
Well,
they're saying that I made a mistake. And one other thing, I also have I'm 64 years old, so last year at the age of 63, I took life insurance, $250,000, and I pay about $9,000 annually, and that comes out of my IRA.
Mm-hmm.
And they think that's a joke, too.
Well, I think if they talk to an attorney about it, they would have another opinion or another view of it. I think you've done a remarkably responsible thing by getting long-term care insurance because you're, number one, you're reducing the burden that New York State might have if someday you had to go on Medicaid and have Medicaid pay for you. Number two, you're protecting the options. Medicaid does a terrific job if you go into a nursing home, but it does, you know, not a really good job for providing home health care. And I think all of us would rather have care at home than in a nursing home if we had that choice. So if you're, you know, to the extent that your policy will pay for it, you'll have the opportunity to stay at home, have home health care aides come in and take care of you in the comfort and privacy of your own home rather than having to go to a nursing home. So if you can afford it, I think long-term care insurance is a terrific thing to have. And you know, those guys are going to do it the way that they want to do it. But quite frankly, you have more options. As far as the life insurance goes, I'm a big believer in life insurance, and particularly a big believer in using an IRA to pay for it. And the reason is that IRA is all tax-deferred money. And someday, if somebody inherits that, you know, for every dollar that they inherit, they're only really inheriting 66 cents because 33 cents of it is going to go to pay income tax. Yeah. If we can use that money while you're alive and use it to pay for life insurance, when they eventually, your beneficiaries eventually get that benefit, not only is it going to be income tax free, but it's also estate tax free. So I think you've made a really smart choice.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lang.
Okay, good luck.
Bill, thank you for a great call. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Janin in Monroe is on. Hi, Janin. Hello?
I'm James from Monroe.
Oh, there
we go.
It says Janin, but James sounds like a more common name. You're up.
Yes. I took care of my parents for 7 years. My father had died. About 3 years, 4 years later, my mom got in a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
And the person from Social Security, not Social Security, but Social Services, said that I gave her all the forms and I could have the house transferred to me.
Right.
Because I was the caregiver and I still live there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have the money to go to get a lawyer. It's been 2 years now. Is there a time limit that I could do that?
No, I think if you qualify for the caregiver exemption, we can still convey the house to you if we have the ability to convey it. So is your mom still living?
Yes, she's still in a nursing home.
Okay. So and is she able to, does she have the legal capacity to sign papers at this point?
No.
Okay. Do you have power of attorney for her?
Yeah, my sister.
Okay. So we could have your sister sign a deed conveying the house from mom to you as the caregiver child, and that would not affect your mom's Medicaid eligibility, and that would be a way of you know, preserving the property against the Medicaid lien. So I would encourage you to talk to a local attorney about doing that.
Do you have any idea how much a local attorney would cost, about just average?
I was cautioned that I shouldn't talk too much about specific prices, but what I will tell you is if you call a local attorney and tell them what you want to do, I'm sure they would give you a price over the phone.
Okay, thank you very much.
How many billable hours is that?
My suspicion to prepare a deed like that is maybe an hour.
Oh, nice.
Because basically, if you've got the old deed, you're going to be copying down the legal description out of the old deed. You're going to get a copy of a current tax bill, and that'll give you the lot, block, and parcel number and the other information you need to fill out the tax forms. It's pretty straightforward.
So it's not too bad. All right. Yeah. Our Frank Lang is our guest. Let's go back to the phones. Terry, if that is your name, in Durham, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling about my 81-year-old mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
And we have unfortunately procrastinated about setting up any kind of a trust. She's widowed, lives on my late father-in-law's retirement money, and has some money in stocks and a house.
Okay.
And she's not in the greatest health. I mean, she still wants to stay in the house for as long as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is it too late to set up a trust?
Not necessarily. I mean, the question is, are we going to be able to keep her out of a nursing home for the next 5 years? And if we think that we can, then there's nothing wrong with going ahead, setting up the trust, getting the assets transferred now, particularly if we've got some family members who might be able to help provide some home care if we get close to that 5-year cutoff but haven't quite made it. And then, you know, even if, let's say that we go through all of that, and then she passes away. It's still probably money well spent because the cost of administering her estate, if we had gone through the regular probate process, typically would have been more than the cost of administering her estate through that trust. Because with a trust, we don't have to go to surrogates court, which means we don't pay a filing fee. We don't have to hire an attorney and pay him legal fees. The trustee just comes in, reads the trust agreement, sees where she wanted her assets to go, and distributes them out. And oftentimes we can do that with virtually no expense.
Ah, okay. And if she had to go into a nursing home, what would happen then within the 5-year period?
If we were close to the end of the 5-year period, typically what I would advise people to do is partially revoke the trust, take out however much money we needed to be able to private pay until we got to the end of the 5-year period. And that way we would still save some of the assets that she has. If something happens in year number two and we know that there isn't enough money in the trust to even get us to the end of the road, then what we're going to end up doing is revoking the trust completely, taking the money back out, using it to pay for the cost of her care until she's spent herself down to the $14,000 level, and then apply for Medicaid for her.
Okay. Okay, great.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Terry, thanks a lot. You know, something you said at the beginning of the show just struck me. People, a lot of people think this will never happen to me.
Indeed, they do. And you know, in the last few years, I've done guardianships for people where they didn't think it was going to happen. They hadn't done any planning. We didn't even have a good power of attorney in place. And we had to go to court and get somebody appointed for a guardian. And the good news is we were able to get the Medicaid planning done. The bad news was we spent somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000 in legal fees to get the guardian appointed. So if people who are listening to this show only come away with one thing, it would be have a power of attorney done if you've got somebody that you trust and you can give them that authority. Because someday, you know, when we're all going to get there, if we get to that point where we can't take care of things for ourselves, we would like to have somebody, and we would like to have picked out who that person is. You know, you don't want to wait and find out it's your least favorite nephew who's the one who steps up to the plate and gets appointed as your guardian.
Yeah, and that's also a Perry Mason episode I once saw. All right, Zach, let's take a break here. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. It's Vox Pop. Frank Lang is here. We'll hit the home stretch and the lightning round coming up.
Support for WAMT comes from Lexington Vacuum, Albany, New York. A local independent vacuum dealer of Miele, Sebo, Dyson, Electrolux, and more, accepting trade-ins towards new vacuum cleaners and offering service and repairs. LEXIVAC.com. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires. AshfieldStone.com. And EDC Warren County, working with communities in the Adirondacks, Lake George, Glens Falls, and Queensbury, providing existing businesses and new businesses with the resources for growth and expansion. EDCWC.org.
Vox Pop on WAMC. We talk estate planning, elder law today with Frank Lang of Lang Law Firm in Latham and Oneonta, New York. And Frank, here's one from email. Brian in Duanesburg writes, please describe and explain the advantages and pitfalls of a life estate deed. How do they calculate the value of the property? That's from Brian in Duanesburg.
Okay. So typically a deed with a reserved life estate is a planning tool that we use when we've got a family residence that we want to protect for Medicaid purposes and don't really have a lot of other stuff that would justify doing a trust. So we'll have a deed from mom and dad or just, you know, whoever the parent is to the ultimate beneficiaries, and it will reserve a life estate in the parents. And what that means is for tax purposes, during the parent's lifetime, they are still considered to be 100% owner of the property. They still get the tax bills. They still keep their veterans exemption and their STAR exemption.
Yeah.
When they eventually pass away, the property is going to transfer now to the kids, and they will get a step up in basis for capital gains tax purposes. So it's a really good methodology for, and the Medicaid regulations say that reserved life estate to mom and dad does not count against them for Medicaid purposes. So it's a way of protecting the house and ensuring all the tax benefits. The downside is this: let's suppose that mom and dad deed the house to the three kids and with a reserved life estate, and 5 years goes by, and now mom and dad want to move to Florida. They now, because the kids have a recorded interest in the house, they're in control of whether or not this property gets sold. So if one of the kids says, no, I don't want to sell, now we're stuck.
Now, does that happen often, or are dysfunctional families that common?
It has happened at least once to me, even after my clients swore up and down that, oh, no, we all get along and the kids will always cooperate. It happened. And so, you know, what we do to try to avoid that is in the deed, we also give what's called a limited power of appointment, which is a legal mechanism that would allow us to change the remainder beneficiaries of the deed and, in essence, get rid of that one child who doesn't want to cooperate.
Now, wouldn't that child who didn't want to cooperate then have legal recourse to say, hey, wait a minute, I'm taking you to court?
And that's exactly what happens, because even though legally under New York State law, we could validly exercise that power of appointment, we can't get a title insurance company to insure that deed because they know that they're buying a litigation
property.
I'm not a big fan of using the deed with a reserved life estate. Instead, I would prefer to use a trust, because with the trust, even though we've named a beneficiary of the trust, New York State has this very weird quirk that says even though we're calling this an irrevocable trust, we can still give you some important powers, including the power to change the beneficiary of the trust. So if down the road you change your mind about who you want to have inherit, you still, as the creator of the trust, have the right to change the beneficiaries.
So a trust works for one, but a life estate deed would be for more than one beneficiary?
No, it's just, if the only thing that we're really concerned about preserving is
a property,
is the piece of property, then doing that deed with the reserve life estate is sort of the cheaper version of doing it. But that presupposes that your kids or whoever those beneficiaries are going to play ball with you.
And agree.
And so it's cheaper, but it's riskier.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And Paul in Fort Henry. Paul, you're on.
Thank you. I have a question. I want to see if my understanding of this is correct. My wife and I have put all of our assets in joint title, house, financial assets. And in the death of either of us, are you hearing me?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. On the death of either of us, it's my understanding we don't have to go to probate.
That's correct.
The one caveat I've read is that we have several vehicles, and they're unfortunately all in my name. I can transfer them, but it's quite expensive. Oh, it's not terrible, but
right.
But they're not worth much.
Okay.
Could she just give them away without going to probate?
Here's what you would want to do.
The
New York State Department of Motor Vehicles has a form. It's MV-349 that allows you to transfer one vehicle upon your death just by filling out a form, as long as the value of that vehicle is worth less than $25,000.
Yeah, I understood that. My question is about the other couple of vehicles.
And with the other couple of vehicles, technically you wouldn't be able to do that without. And you might be able to do it with the use of something called a small estates affidavit. But my recommendation would be is if you plan on continuing to own those vehicles for a while, it's probably worth having them titled jointly now. You know, bite the bullet, spend the extra whatever it is at DMV to get it titled that way, because it's going to simplify things later on.
What if she just gave them away?
If you give them away now during your lifetime, that's fine. But if it's titled in your name, right?
She can't give it away.
Yeah, she doesn't have the authority to do it.
Okay.
All right.
Well, you've been very helpful. I guess it's worth it to get that change. Everything else, we don't have to do like household property, but the house and all of our financial assets are in both of our names.
Yeah, and typically that's what I recommend to my clients, is that you want to have everything joint with the husband and wife, and then when the first person passes away, now everything automatically by operation of law belongs to the surviving spouse. At that stage of the game, we want to encourage you to make those assets either joint or payable on death to whoever your ultimate beneficiaries are.
And we wouldn't have to do anything. The banks and things about the demise of one of us, and that's it.
Right. When the first person goes, everything still, automatically belongs to the survivor.
Thank you. You've been very helpful.
You're welcome.
Paul, thanks a lot. Let's go over to Langdon in Milford, Pennsylvania. Nice to hear from Pennsylvania. You're on, Langdon.
Hey, good afternoon, guys.
Langdon, I'm sorry. Yep, you're
good.
My question is I have, I'm in a domestic partnership with my fiance, her and I, she has a lot of school debt. I do not. When we become married, I'm only doing this because she needs insurance. She has no coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And she has she has quite a bit of school debt that she's paying off at the minimum.
Mm-hmm.
If she fails to pay when we become married, would that become my responsibility at that point, or have I already entered that realm by making her my domestic partner?
Great question.
That is a good question. And those kind of decisions vary from state to state. In New York State, if you became married and you were living in New York State law would say, yes, you are obligated on her student debt. I don't know what the rule is in Pennsylvania, and so that's probably a good thing to check on before you pull the trigger, and just so you know what you're getting into.
But also, now that they are already engaged, are they beholden to that situation?
And again, I'm not that familiar with Pennsylvania law and what exactly the implications of a domestic partnership are versus an outright marriage. So mm-hmm. So I would suggest that you want to talk to a Pennsylvania attorney and see if you can get that question answered there.
Right. We really only did the domestic partnership because, she had no coverage. She's not working very many hours, and mm-hmm. now we're having our first baby, and I just want to make sure everything's covered, and I don't want to do the whole state thing. I don't agree with it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make sure that I pay for the insurance that she gets.
No, and I think that's very nice of you to do that. I'm just saying I don't know what the answer is in Pennsylvania, but I'm sure you could find a Pennsylvania attorney who could answer that for you.
Okay, but in any state, for that matter, not any state, in New York or even Pennsylvania, I guess, the domestic partnership does not constitute my responsibility to her debt yet, correct?
And again, I'm not an expert on domestic partnerships. So I know that once you become married, there are statutes in New York State that talk about your spousal obligation. It's under the Family Court Act here, and that's something that typically a court would say that you were responsible for. But if you're at that domestic partnership step, I just don't know if that qualifies for purposes of the statute to obligate you.
Okay, at that point, when I do become responsible, if it is the same, if it is reciprocal, and I am responsible, is it something that could be garnished?
I would suspect so, yeah.
Okay.
Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid, and congratulations on the new baby.
There you go.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot. Let's go over to Frank in Athens. Frank, you're on.
Hi. I have a lease, a commercial lease in a small building that is adjacent to a residential building, an apartment building, and the owner of the complex has indicated that the property may be going into foreclosure. My question is, will my lease survive the foreclosure?
As a general proposition, if your lease is for a specific period of time, the mere fact that the landlord has been foreclosed upon isn't necessarily going to wipe out your property rights. But that's an area of law that I don't practice in regularly, so I think I'm going to have to say I'm not sure on that one.
Okay. Is there a recommendation in terms of going to a specific real estate attorney?
Yeah, I think you would want to talk to an attorney who does commercial real estate.
Okay. There should be plenty of them out there. Frank, thanks a lot. By the way, Frank Lang, what is your contact information if people want to get a hold of you?
You can call me on the phone at 690-0668, and that's in area code 518. If you want to call my Oneonta office, that's area code 607-432-6655. And we're located at my main office is 12 Cornell Road in Latham.
Okay, and do you have a website?
I do not currently.
Frank,
I know.
We need to get you a website. All right, let's go to Stephen in Albany. Stephen, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I heard what you were saying about paying a life insurance policy with an IRA.
Mm-hmm.
I'm intrigued. I have an irrevocable trust with $1 million whole life policy in it. I have an IRA. I'm 49. What are the mechanics?
Well, basically, and that's the problem. If you wanted to use that money in your IRA, is this a traditional IRA?
Yes.
Yeah. So until you get to be 59 and a half, you can't really access it without paying a penalty. So that may not be something that's going to work for you at that age. You know, as my clients get older, once they get to the point where they can access the IRA money without having to pay a penalty on it, then it's a nice way of converting tax burden money into money that's not going to be tax burden. But at your stage of the game, I think it probably wouldn't make sense.
Oh, sure. But I hope to make 59 and a half someday.
Okay.
When
you hit that point, you to the extent that you need to, you're going to withdraw money from the IRA and you're going to use that money to pay the premiums on your life insurance policy. As you're withdrawing that money, it's going to be taxable income to you. But you're going to be using it. You're going to be leveraging it to buy a bigger amount of insurance that ultimately will go to your beneficiaries, estate tax free and income tax free.
I see, and I have an irrevocable trust to keep the ex-wife's fingers off it. So mm-hmm. That's another great way to keep that all safe from her.
Exactly.
Nicely done.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Faipal. Where are you calling from? Hello?
Hello.
Is this Faipal?
No, this is Cecil.
Ah, okay. Well, you're on.
Okay, great. Thanks for taking my call. I want to ask a question. I live down in Georgia.
Okay.
And my parents live here in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I live in Buffalo, rather. And I have two other siblings that live down in Georgia from my daddy's first marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a mother, which is really my stepmother, but she's sick, and my siblings in New York wanted to put her in a nursing home, but found she had too much money to go into a nursing home without paying a certain amount along with her Medicare.
Right.
And so they opt not to put her in. So she stays at home with my dad. And but what I'm trying to ask is about my siblings living down in Georgia, along with me. I live in Georgia, too. I'm in Albany now. I'm a truck driver. And
mm-hmm.
I work for a major furniture company, and I be in New York all the time. But the question is, my siblings, my brother and sister, decided with my mother's money that since she had already have a certain amount of money, that each one would get $1,000 alternate month. Where my brother would get $1,000 this month, the next month my sister would get $1,000. And, you know, well, so they just do whatever they want with the money. No accountability. Okay, suppose my father, something like this happened to him, and the two siblings that in Buffalo opt to do his money that way. Is there any way that I can, me and my two siblings down in Georgia, can guard against that happening, maybe by hiring a lawyer now to see what happened? Because unfortunately, you know, my parents are the people that don't really like to talk about inner life things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an unfortunate thing, but is there any way as a pre-op that I can hire a lawyer now to maybe preempt something like that happening, say, like with my father's money.
Sure.
In other words, I don't have a problem right now with what they are doing, which is it's probably not right, but even at that, I don't have a problem with it. It's their mother.
All right.
Well, and I'm more or less.
And I see this kind of situation come up, and I don't know from this point if the money that they're getting paid is to. If they're providing healthcare services or the equivalent of healthcare services that you know we would have to be paying an outsider to do, if that's the case, there's nothing wrong with paying a family member to do it, and it's not going to affect their Medicaid eligibility as long as we can document that that's what's happened. But if there's a concern that somebody's being overreached or taken advantage of, then there are a lot of options you can take. You can hire a private attorney to look into it and try to, you know, cut that action off, or you can contact the Adult Protective Services through the local departments of social services, and they'll come out and investigate, and they'll take a look at it and see if they think that there's something untoward going on. And if there is, then the Adult Protective Services will intervene on your behalf. So if you have a concern about it, there are certainly things that can be done to protect that elderly relative.
Okay, then. Well, like I said, in my case, she lived there with my father, and I assume my father take whatever left of her money and all. But they provide for her care, my father, and, you know, mm-hmm. he hires somebody to come in from time to time, and on and on and on, and my brother live in one place, my sister live in another, but again, that's not my main concern. It's more or less if something like this should happen to my father.
Okay.
In other words, is there a way that I can hire a lawyer to preempt or to look out for me and my siblings down in Georgia?
Sure.
Our best interest in, you know, by a chance something happened that they can't manage their own funds.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that, you know, you ought to be encouraging your father to do is to have a power of attorney in place so that...
Oh, I think I lost you.
Okay, well, we got to go anyway, but thank you very much for listening. So a power of attorney would be the first step there.
The power of attorney would be a good idea because that way Dad can appoint whatever agent he thinks is going to be looking out for his interest to make those kind of decisions if he gets to the point where he can't do it himself.
Frank Lang, great job today. Again, your contact information?
In the area code 518-690-0668 or 607-432-6655.
Well, thank you to Frank, and thanks to everybody who called in today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who was our engineer, Colleen O'Connell, who answered the phones, Jessica Blaustein Marshall, our producer. Support comes from Empire Exhibits and Displays, Albany, New York. Custom exhibits, interactive displays, and commercial casework for trade shows, events, museums, and corporate interiors, empireexhibits.com. Piano Summer at New Paltz, celebrating its 20th year, July 12th through August 1st, concluding with a symphony gala with the Hudson Valley Philharmonic, Vladimir Feltzman conducting August 1st at 8, newpaltz.edu/piano. and Curran Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York, hosting a national symposium on life insurance compliance November 12th through the 14th at the Gideon Putnam Resort, Saratoga Springs, with reservations now open, currancompliance.com. Thanks again for being with us today. I'm Ray Graff. Now, tomorrow, we got another great show for you. It's Birds with Rich Guthrie.